Hey, everybody. Welcome to Therapy Rocks, a personal growth podcast. I'm your host, Signe Darpinian, co-author of No Way, A Teen's Guide to Positive Body Image, Food, and Emotional Wisdom. My guest today is award-winning writer Sarah Gilliam, who has teamed up with her mother, best-selling nonfiction author Mary Pfeiffer, to revisit Pfeiffer's American classic Reviving Ophelia with the 25th anniversary edition published less than a year ago with Penguin. Sarah is going to talk to us today about being the original Ophelia, the trends of adolescent girls' mental health over a 25-year span, and give us some tips for helping our youth navigate social media. Sarah, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. I am delighted to be here.
So Sarah, the original book, Reviving Ophelia, became a national phenomenon after its release in 1994, and I remember this. It spent 3 years on the New York Times bestseller list, 27 weeks at number one, and began a conversation about adolescent girls' mental health. And this made the author, your mother, Mary Pfeiffer, a household name. And she wrote the book with you in mind. You were the original Ophelia. So I'd love to hear more about how the two of you decided to join forces and rewrite the 25th anniversary edition.
Yeah, you bet. So it was as many good ideas come about. This came about in the shower. And actually, I like to take credit for this because 95% of the good ideas in this book are my mother's incredible thinking. I'm just kind of along for the ride. But several years ago, I was taking a shower one morning, getting ready for work. And I thought, the 25th anniversary of Reviving Ophelia is coming out. And that's a big deal. This was a really important book for the culture. And so I emailed my mom and her agent and just said, hey, 2019 will be the 25th anniversary. You ought to reach out to the publisher about doing a re-edition or something. I in no way was imagining I'd be a part of this. I just was sort of emailing off the top of my head. But as it turned out, the editor, my mom's editor and the publisher was very interested in re-releasing the book, but recognized very quickly, as did we, that they couldn't just slap a new cover on the book and kind of send it out into the world. It'd be a disservice to this new generation of girls and the people who care about them because so much has changed since 1994 when the book was originally released. So I will give you a couple bits of insight into how we tackled this project. It was so much fun. We had some nerves, to be honest, as an adult daughter and mother taking on a project like this because we've managed to work through our sort of typical mother-daughter relationship through the teenage years. And you know, I was 40 at the time we started working on this book, and we didn't want it to hurt our relationship or put us into a place where we'd be arguing over copy edits, things like that. But none of that came to pass. It was really an incredible experience. We began by sending copies of the original Reviving Ophelia to girls all around North America. I used social media to reach out to friends and to strangers and say, hey, we're looking for some really sharp high school girls in all different kinds of communities from all different kinds of backgrounds to read this book and tell us what still applies, what still feels really relevant to your life in 2019 or 2018, and what should we scrap and what's missing. And so we really used those girls' ideas and their written edits in the paperback books to inform our research. And so we took the information they shared with us, and then we held focus groups with middle schoolers, focus groups with high schoolers, and focus groups with mothers of adolescent girls. And then in addition to that, we did, you know, dozens of interviews with individual girls. And I did most of those. I'm a former middle school teacher. I really, really like hanging out with teenagers and talking to them. And my mom was actually finishing her own book at the same time. So I did most of the interviews. And then we worked together over Google Docs, just like people are doing today in the era of COVID, right? We would have video calls and we would share a big Google Doc and swap ideas. And we spent about 18 months total on the project. We cut about 35,000 words from the original book and wrote about as many, in new words, new content. So we really wanted, I think the thing I want to underscore is that we wanted to make this book feel relevant for this new generation because they're grappling with a lot of different outside stimuli and a different culture than the girls in 94 that my mom had written about.
Well, and Sarah, I know that you write about the risk-taking and rebellion that's characteristic of the 90s adolescent girls, which I can relate to. I was one of those kids, although I'm a little older. And that after the focus groups you were talking about in the interviews that you did for 18 months for the new edition, you found that the modern adolescent girl is more risk-averse and cautious. I'm wondering if you could say more about that.
Yeah, you bet. I mean, that was one of the most surprising things that we figured out. And we figured it out pretty early in those focus groups. We talked about girls of my mom's generation, because the book actually looks at everything from the 60s to the present day. My mom grew up in the 60s, and she feels that girls in her era were confident. They were ready to go out. They were excited to go to college or to work. She felt like her peers were just sort of armed, generally speaking, with the confidence they needed to tackle their adult lives. They had a lot of independence. They did a lot of caretaking for younger siblings, that kind of thing. And then, as you mentioned, I came of age really at the zenith of sort of these rebellious, risk-taking girls. It was the height of the dysfunctional family model of therapy. Girls were piercing things and dyeing their hair all different colors and fighting with their parents. There was a lot of conflict. And now we look at girls today and we realized they're cautious. And that may feel a little bit counterintuitive. And we can spend this whole podcast talking about the factors that play into that. But a couple of the biggest, I would say, first of all, the family unit pulls together in times of fear or insecurity. And we have a lot less economic stability as a country, if we're looking at the US, than we did in the 90s, which were the Clinton years, which were a fairly prosperous time for the kind of middle-class Americans. But we also just have, we've got a 24-hour news cycle. We've got the lockdown generation and the culture of school shootings. We've got global terrorism. Of course, now we throw the coronavirus into the mix. But there are all of these things, and our awareness of these things is enhanced, that are kind of, I don't know, coming together, coalescing to have families become closer and girls more inclined, and we'll talk about this more, but girls more inclined to stay home on a Friday or Saturday night than they would have in past generations. So this generation is really different. And of course, a big piece of this as well is the fact that they can now create a version of themselves online and live out much of their social life and their kind of discretionary time in online relationships rather than in-person relationships.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that too. Are there problems associated with staying at home?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are some very positive things, first of all. I mean, one thing that's really changed since the 90s, just as an example, is the mother-daughter relationship. And as I mentioned, again, in the early 90s, we saw sort of looking at the data and looking at what therapists were seeing, kind of the height of conflict between girls and their mothers. And that has really changed. There's still tension in middle school. There always probably will be. It's developmentally appropriate. It's just a tough time. But by high school, most of the girls that we talked to were reporting, my mom is my best friend. I tell her everything. I feel close with my family. So some of this is not bad. Sort of the resurgence of family meals together, or everyone kind of snuggling up on the couch and watching a movie. There is kind of a problematic flip side, however, which is that there's a lot less opportunities for girls today to discover their own efficacy and independence and some of that confidence that we've seen in past generations. So just a couple small examples of that. Research shows, and this is from the Monitoring the Future Project at the University of Michigan. Research shows us that teenagers in general, girls as well, are getting their driver's licenses a lot less frequently. Hmm. And I don't know about you, Signe, but I was at the DMV at 8 o'clock on the morning of my 16th birthday. And I could not wait to have that independence, right? And one more way that I can sort of differentiate myself from my parents, be out of the house, be out, exploring with friends, all of that. girls are much less inclined to do that. And they're also less inclined in 2019, 2020 to be working outside of the home. And if you think about what we learn from those experiences as a teenager, one thing I've talked about in speeches is I remember a time in high school when a friend and I drove from Lincoln, Nebraska to Minneapolis for a concert, and we ended up getting a flat tire in downtown Minneapolis. And it was horrible and it was terrifying. And we had to, we had to find a payphone, we had to find a quarter, we had to figure out a tow truck. All of this stuff as 16-year-old girls, I wouldn't want to relive it. But when we got the tire changed, we're back on the road, we felt amazing and strong and powerful and capable. So those experiences are important. We grow from stress, and having those opportunities to face some kind of calibrated, manageable, real life stress is a really important part of adolescence. So likewise, if you think of your first job outside the house, I mean, I think about mine, I worked at a small grocery store. You're dealing with difficult people. You're dealing with grumpy people. You maybe have some kind of unusual suspects coming in, and you've got to strategize about how best to support them if they're your customer. And you learn how to talk to a boss and how to talk to a colleague, and you learn responsibility and all of these things. And so the more that girls are electing to stay home, and we know now, for example, the MO for the typical teenage girl, about 9 hours a day on social media primarily. And a Saturday night looks like watching Netflix and group texting with friends or Snapchatting with friends. We know that while that can seem fun in the moment, it's really taking away girls' ability to have face-to-face conversations, to connect with members of their community. And then that kind of spills over when they finally leave the house to go to college or to work or whatnot. They're not ready. And that's when we see some real spikes in anxiety. So there's, you know, I apologize, there are a lot of moving parts to this. And I think there are a lot of factors. But the bottom line is we definitely see some detriments to today's teenage girls when they're not getting out of the house, you know, and they're not putting their phones down, talking to their neighbors, volunteering or getting part-time jobs, that kind of thing.
You just made me think about a lot of my youth. But again, mine was more late 80s, maybe driving even a little before 16.
Oh, me too. Me too, Signa.
Little bit, right. That was the norm. And yeah, thinking, you know, about the first jobs that we had and how it really gave us something to wrestle with. And I was listening to another podcast recently, and they were talking about how, you know, success doesn't come from too many obstacles, you know, too many things to wrestle with, but it certainly... Success doesn't, you know, depending on how you're defining success, but it certainly doesn't come from not having enough to wrestle with, that we need a strategic amount of discomfort to really investigate ourselves and to learn more. So I never thought of it that way. That is so interesting.
One thing that we've started urging in workshops and in conversations with mothers is that they help create what we're calling calibrated stress for their daughter. And on one hand, it feels a bit ludicrous that we've got to even create this, right? Or we have to have a catchy name for this. But it's really true. We need to have these manageable amounts of stress. You know, a simple way to do this, for example, is tell a girl who's a senior in high school, you know, you're probably going away to college next year. This year, I want you to be in charge of your doctor and dentist appointments. And you've got to figure out how you're going to get yourself to track practice. And if you need a ride, that needs to be on dad's calendar a week in advance. You know, put them in the position where they have some decision-making authority. They're planning a vacation for the family, or they're in charge of their calendar in a way they haven't been before, offering them these little bits of calibrated stress to build up that confidence that they're going to need when they leave the home.
Sarah, I love that calibrated stress. And I definitely can relate to what you're talking about. I'm a therapist who treats adolescent girls, and I treat other people as well, but most of my caseload are adolescent girls. And it is interesting. Most of them do not have jobs, nor do they have their driver's license, even as they are graduating from high school. So I definitely see the things that you're talking about in the book. So, Sarah, I want to back up a little bit. I'm curious about growing up in your household, being the original Ophelia. And I'm wondering, what was it like to grow up with the topic of young women's mental health just surrounding you?
I love this question. I never get asked this question. You know, by and large, of course, I had a great childhood. Both of my parents are clinical psychologists. So it wasn't just my mom shining that high beam light on me when I became an adolescent. It was kind of both of them. And I've always told people who ask what that was like growing up with two psychologists that honestly, it meant I felt heard and seen. And I had two parents who were very good at talking about feelings, drawing me out when I was kind of in a sullen teenagery mode, getting me laughing, helping me feel some perspective or change the subject. I mean, it was a very interesting experience when my mom was writing this book, because I was a junior and senior in high school. And of course, those are pretty intense times in and of themselves. And then you throw in the fact that my mom is interviewing my girlfriends to be some of the strong girls in the book. And she would have me go through and edit for sort of teen accuracy in the dialogue. In other words, oh, mom, a teenager would never say this, you know, or kind of teasing out pop culture references, things like that. So it was really fun. I was involved in it. I got to go with her on some of her early press junket and media appearances and things like that. The main thing I will say is that I feel like she gave me a very strong foundation as a feminist that has stuck with me, because she was really a voice in the culture saying, no, the problem isn't in these young women's heads. It's not them. It's not their mothers or their dysfunctional families. It's the culture. And oh my gosh, I mean, I can remember so clearly, if I happened to have friends over and my mom got started talking about MTV or advertisements in Rolling Stone, I'd be rolling my eyes, but I really took it all in as well, to be honest. And we had a couple arguments, I remember, when I was a teenager, because she was really anti-Madonna. Mm. She wrote about Madonna's sex book and about Madonna's music videos and how she portrayed herself. And as ever a pop music lover, I was very insulted that she was going after my queen. But that was probably as intense as our skirmishes got. The other thing that was funny is we did agree when we started promoting Reviving Ophelia that it was likely that people were going to ask us about our relationship and that we were going to respond with, we had a typical mother-daughter relationship, which is just a lovely way of saying we had a lot of conflict. We had a tough time. I was that rebellious, risk-taking early 90s girl. We argued when I wanted to dye my hair blue. We argued when I would miss curfew. So I think she was really in the trenches of it, both as a mother and as a therapist. But the book itself actually became a bestseller and really became a phenomenon after I had gone away to college. And so I missed a lot of her rise as sort of a cultural leader and thinker, which has been a lot of fun to watch. But none of that was actually unfolding while I was still in the house.
Were there times where you ever felt like a research subject?
Yes, a little bit. Although generally a willing one. I remember, I've hardly ever told this story, but it is funny. There was a time I remember when I was probably younger, maybe in middle school, and came home, and I remember someone had called me, you know, like chubby or fat, had made a comment about my weight at school, and I was really hurt, and I was in my room crying, and I was frustrated, and I remember my mom came in and sat down, and she said that classic therapy line, you know, how does that make you feel? And I remember looking at her and going, fat, like, I don't want to talk about my feelings. I just want you to acknowledge that this sucks and I'm mad, you know. She was great at doing that too. You know, she was great. She was a great mom. And I really look back now and realize how far we've come, of course, that the adult child and parent relationship is a really special thing. But I also see that she was laying the groundwork as a feminist, as a writer, as an activist for much of where I would go professionally across the, you know, the next 25 years. So I have, you know, very few sour grapes or anything like that about this era, but it was, it was a wild ride for sure. And I definitely felt like anything clever I might accidentally say at the dinner table was fair game for a quote in the book I wrote.
I love that. And, you know, in the book, you talk about something really fascinating to me, which makes sense, but I had never put it together. You talk about the upward trend on young women's mental health from, you know, the 1994 until 2007, which was the year that the iPhone launched, where there was then a steep downward turn. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked about that. It's really striking. So we know, again, from research, that the early 90s were sort of the toughest time, the worst or bleakest time in terms of girls' happiness and mental health. There was a lot of self-harm. There was a lot of suicide or suicide attempts. There was a lot of drinking and maybe problematic behaviors or dangerous behaviors. And then I think largely in part, largely because of Reviving Ophelia, and then many other excellent books and programs followed it or came out around the same time. Girls empowerment programs, things like that, camps for girls, the cultural conversation shifted and things began to improve. And just as an aside, we took out all of the material from the original book on, for example, academic parity, because my mom had written quite a bit about the fact that girls were not called on as much as boys in school. They weren't encouraged to access higher education as much as boys. Some girls reported maybe not speaking up because they didn't want to seem intelligent because that might make them less attractive to boys. And a lot of that has kind of resolved itself culturally, you know, through some great programming and some great initiatives, through all of the STEM focused girls camps and things like that, that we see. So the cultural conversation about girls really began to change in the early to mid 90s. But then if we look at all of these charts of sort of girls' mental health, happiness, and so on a steady rise from the mid 90s to 2007, then we see them begin to plummet. And 2007 is the year the iPhone was launched and that we started to dip our toes into the worlds of social media and sort of this second self online. So that's a very important comparison or correlation to draw. And the more that we talk to girls, the more we realize that social media and time online impact every single aspect of adolescent development. And those original girls that we sent the book to and said, you know, mark this up, make notes for us, wrote all over the place in all caps, social media, social media, social media. Every original chapter in that book has a new afterword that relates to social media and how that's changed life and development for teenagers. So it's striking and it's really important. We see this significant decline in girls' mental health and a huge spike. I'm sure I've noticed this as a therapist, huge spike in anxiety. The original Reviving Ophelia didn't even have a chapter on anxiety, but the new book does. And of course, there's a pretty strong reason for that.
I saw that there's an added chapter on anxiety, and I definitely see that in my caseload. Mm-hmm. But I love that term or the phrase second self. Mm. I've never heard that before. Second self, like your social media self.
Yeah. I mean, think about it. We talked to girls, you know, they said things like, if I post a picture online, if I don't get X number of likes in 15 minutes, I take it down. The comparison game is huge. I size up every girl within 5 seconds and decide if she's prettier than me. If I don't get enough attention online, I feel hurt. I feel like I'm not attractive. I feel like I'm not cool. And I think if we're being honest, many adult women can relate to those feelings. I know I've taken photos down.
Absolutely.
If I felt like they weren't gaining enough traction online. So I certainly don't fault young girls for grappling with all of this. You know, and then we see a huge rise of YouTube and TikTok stars. They're becoming as influential as the celebrities of our era of, you know, movie stars or musicians. A lot of them are beauty gurus talking about fitness and makeup or editing images for maximum sex appeal, this kind of thing. So there's this whole new world. And what we found in talking to girls is that they're spending an enormous amount of time cultivating and curating this online self. And this online self is often prettier, more lively, happier, having more experiences. You know, the whole notion of FOMO, right? So that they're constantly out with others, they're someplace exciting, doing something exciting. And that really sets girls up to feel split, where they've got the one person they are who might be a straight A student and a loving daughter, but then they're also incredibly lonely because they don't have more than just a handful of sort of superficial friendships or relationships with people outside of social media.
I saw that in the book where you talk about, you know, having 10,000 followers, but maybe only a couple of friends or feeling lonely, despite the fact that there are so many followers.
There was actually, that comes from a panel at South by Southwest a couple of years ago that was called something like 10,000 followers and no friends or something like
that. Oh, wow.
Yeah. Which was looking at exactly that issue, but they really are struggling to figure out how do I live in both of these worlds? And again, I think as adults, we can see how quickly use of social media, use of devices can get out of hand. And we are theoretically as adults better equipped to manage those two worlds and straddle those two worlds.
Mm, but well said.
If it's difficult for us, it's very difficult for a 13-year-old girl.
Well said. Sarah, what would your top 3 tips be for parents and guardians to helping youth navigate the online world?
You got to sit down with your teenager and look at what they're doing online. Again, okay. If we know that a girl is spending 6 to 9 hours a day online, and we know that girls are mostly texting and on social media sites, whereas boys tend to do more YouTube and gaming, just as an interesting gender disparity.
Okay.
You wouldn't let your daughter spend that much time with a friend without having met the friend or met the family or stopped by the house. It's that same kind of thing. My personal example is that my older son loves to watch Minecraft tutorial videos on YouTube. I don't think there's anything more mind-numbingly painful on earth than those videos, but I did make myself sit down with him at some point because while he may be watching something that feels appropriate, what's the next video that auto loads, you know, or what are the recommended videos on the side? And you look at Instagram, you know, ask your daughter, who are you following? What influencers do you like? What do you like to watch on TikTok? I mean, I did the last time I gave a keynote speech in February, I went on TikTok for an hour and just surfed videos. And I was, even as a fairly plugged in and open-minded person, I was really appalled by what I saw in just an hour of flipping through TikTok. So we're doing our girls a huge disservice if we're not dialed into what they're looking at.
Why do you think we don't?
You know, I think that's a great question. We talk to mothers about this.
Yeah, because I don't either. And it's really bizarre.
You don't either?
No, I don't. I have a 10-year-old and I avoid it a little bit. I get a little too loose.
I do too. I mean, I think some of it is that it's boring or it's not of interest to us.
Okay.
And if they're content and happy, we're content and happy, right?
Yeah.
Especially now when we're all stuck in houses together for hours a day. But the mothers that we talked to, all of them said, or almost all of them, that they had come up with a pact with their daughter when they bought them their first phone, usually in middle school, which was, okay, don't take sexy selfies and don't send nudes around. And, you know, we, mom and dad, or mom and mom, can look at your phone whenever we want and read your texts and be up to speed. This isn't private. Something like that.
Okay.
And then I said, so have any of you ever taken your daughters up on that pact? And not a single one had. And one mother said, oh, my daughter would be horrified, you know? But I think that is just, it's an expectation that they've set up and haven't followed through on, which of course happens all the time as a parent. Yeah. We have other things to do. But I think it's a really important one. And the other thing I would say that kind of goes along with this is these conversations have to happen more than once.
Yeah.
You know, TikTok didn't even exist just over a year ago. So this is a moving target, and what the online world looks like is changing all the time. So unfortunately, this can't be a one and done conversation. A couple other things that I strongly recommend are some basic family agreements, harness that democratic parenting approach. So you're not handing down rules. You're not saying we're going to do X, Y, and Z, but sit with your child or your children and say, here are my pain points around your use on devices. What kind of life do you want in 5 years? What are your goals? How does social media fit into this? What are our family values? And try as a group to come up with some simple agreements. Maybe it is that all phones charge in the kitchen overnight. Beds are for sleeping. You don't need to be sensitive to every notification coming in at 3 a.m. But as much as possible, if those can be mutual conversations versus a handing down of rules, I think parents are likely to get a little more traction with them. And then the final thing I think is really helpful, and we heard this from a lot of the girls we talked with, is actually inviting girls to make some peer-to-peer agreements.
I love that, Sarah. I think that is the coolest idea.
It's so cool, and it's exactly what we should be doing with our adolescent girls. So first of all, be that family that, again, a little bit tricky in the time of COVID, but be that family that hosts the pizza parties, buy the soda and the pizzas, have your daughter invite those girls she's on a group thread with to actually come hang out at the house.
Okay.
And then encourage them to talk about, are there some agreements we could make that would make our lives easier? So some of the things we heard directly from girls were, I don't look at my phone after 8 p.m. My friends know that, so they're not hurt if they text me and I don't reply. Or we all take, you know, Instagram off of our phones during the school week and just reinstall it on the weekend. My anecdotal experience of talking to the girls, but also thinking about what's likely to stick, I think getting a group of girls to make some agreements together as friends to support each other is likely to have more staying power than a rule from a parent, a school, you know, and so on.
And do you see them actually following through?
Yeah. Yes. And then of course, following through. And the girls we talked to really, really did. I mean, we see now, again, we're looking at a real specific demographic with this book, right? And we definitely brought into the lens from the original in terms of more immigrant and refugee girls, girls of color, girls in urban and rural areas, that kind of thing. But we still are to a point looking at sort of the quote unquote typical middle American teenage girl. So looking at that girl, I think these peer-to-peer agreements can go a long way. A lot of those girls feel a lot of anxiety around higher education. They know they need to get scholarships if they want to go to college. They care about their schoolwork. They're inclined to make good decisions. They may just be at a place where they really don't know what a good decision looks like. And again, fair enough. This world is confusing enough to navigate as an adult. But when you're trying to figure out as a teenager, you know, what is the effect of the time I'm spending looking at my phone on my future and my dreams and my development? They've got to have someone stepping in to help them have those thoughtful conversations.
Yeah. And I love how you say that this generation is an entire generation that we're experimenting with.
Yeah. We are in so many ways, if you think of it. This is the first generation that has grown up post-Columbine, which means that pretty much every American kid is growing up in a culture of active shooter drills. Mm-hmm. And we have absolutely no idea what the effects of this amount of screen time are.
Right.
And the effects on identity, character development, future prognosis. What is this generation of kids going to look like that don't know how to interview for a high school job or talk to the neighbor down the street about her garden? And it's so funny because my mom used to make examples like this and I found them very hokey. And now apparently I'm very hokey too, because at 43, I recognize, okay, my kid can be great at Clash Royale. And if that makes him happy, that's his right. I also want him to know how to build a fire in my fire pit and make eye contact with and have a good conversation with my neighbor. So we need to look at that whole range of skills we want to arm our children with as we prepare to launch them into the world, and where social media and devices fit into that as a part of it, but not an all-consuming part of it, ideally.
I love that. What's the solution? What are some of the positives about social media?
Well, I think I've been reflecting on this a lot in the last 2 months, because suddenly we're all on Zoom calls, right? And we're all online all the time because we don't really have a choice. And so I certainly appreciate the role that social media or the online world can play in creating communities. The biggest example that we point to in Reviving Ophelia is a real meteoric rise in youth activism. Hmm. And of course, young people have always led social movements, been a part of the leadership of social movements. But Twitter or Insta have been places where young people can find each other and organize. And so the, you know, Me Too, Never Again, March for Our Lives, a lot of those movements really built their followings and their mission statements and their platforms on social media. And we talked to girls in sort of disparate parts of the US who said, yeah, I follow the kids from Parkland, Florida on social media, and they inspired me to start a club at my own school to talk about gun violence. And I really think, and then we also can see all kinds of great, of course, every noxious message kids are getting online, teenagers are getting online. We have wonderful people. I'm very partial to Jameela Jamil.
Oh, yeah.
People who are rising up with positive messages about beauty and acceptance and embracing all of our differences. And so I think there are ways. I'm not a blanket anti-social media person, not at all. But I think we've let the train just go shooting out of the station without pushing those brakes and saying, how do we navigate this carefully and thoughtfully and with consideration? And how can we find that great content that's out there, those great apps that are out there that are going to enhance our teenagers' lives rather than stymie them?
Well, and Sarah, thank you so much for not only taking the time to come on the show today, but for Reviving Ophelia for a New Generation. This is such important work. And I'll end with this piece that I love that you said. You state in the book that across a 25-year span, our culture has changed, but the needs of adolescent girls have remained remarkably consistent.
Yeah, it's so true. And if you think about what you needed back in the 80s and 90s, what my mom needed in the 60s, we need to be loved. We need to feel safe. We need to feel challenged. We need to ask ourselves those big questions about our dreams and our goals. We need to sit around with our friends and talk endlessly about our feelings. We need nurtured and we need protected from the noxious aspects of our culture and exposed to those aspects that are beautiful.
I love those takeaways. And Sarah, what is the best way for our listeners to reach you or to find out more about Reviving Ophelia, the 25th anniversary edition?
I've got a website, which is sarahgilliamwrites.com. And then I've got an author page on Facebook. So those are probably the two best ways.
Thank you again for joining us today for another episode of Therapy Rocks. And a reminder that you can rate and review me on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And feel free to contact me at www.signadarpinian.com. I'll see you next month.